Welcome to this special episode of the Employee Safety Podcast. I'm Peter Steinfeld. This month marks the 20th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, which claimed more than 1,000 lives and displaced over a million people in the Gulf Coast region. We honor those individuals today, along with the first responders and countless others impacted by this devastating storm. Hurricane Katrina fundamentally reshaped emergency response in the United States by exposing flaws in preparedness and response efforts. This led to significant changes in how governments, businesses, and communities manage emergencies and ensure the safety of their people. Today's guest can speak to this firsthand. Bonnie Canal is a proud New Orleans native who experienced Hurricane Katrina personally. She's a nationally recognized leader in disaster preparedness, community resilience, and business continuity strategies. Bonnie is the manager of business continuity at Tulane University, where she leads the development, testing, and maintenance of the school's university-wide operational resilience plans. She's also a certified FEMA instructor, a trainer for Disaster Recovery International, and has won numerous industry awards and honors. I think you'll find Bonnie's Hurricane Katrina story both valuable and insightful. She discusses what it was like to evacuate, return, and rebuild, and the lessons learned that continue to shape her work in business continuity and operational resilience. Hey, Bonnie, it's really great to have you back on the show. I appreciate you sharing your story with us today.
Thanks, Peter. Thanks for having me, and I really look forward to having this conversation with you today.
Well, take us back to August 2005, when you realized Hurricane Katrina would be a really major storm. What emergency communications and guidance did New Orleans residents receive?
The city had never called for an evacuation ever in the history of the city. And so when they started talking about this, the need to push this information out became really, really challenging. And even myself, who was a native, I mean, I've lived through many storms here. I mean, we start with the last major storm that hit here in the late 1960s, which Hurricane Betsy was up to that point was the line, but we stayed for that as well. So part of this was there was this lack of understanding of what we were really talking about. And then when it came to evacuation, this idea is, what are we really doing here? Like, do we really have to evacuate? Do we really not have to evacuate? That's kind of the situation that New Orleanians found themselves in on the Sunday before the hurricane actually hit. So there was a lot of, I don't want to say misinformation, but there was this lack of belief that this was actually going to affect us. And the one thing that people ask me, like, why did I evacuate? Why did I listen? So when I met Max Mayfield, who was at the time the head of the Hurricane Center down in Miami, and he got on the radio, on the TV, and he was telling everybody, you needed to evacuate. But the first thing he said was, if you're going to stay, you're going to need your hurricane supplies that you're going to stay. So he listed the normal supplies. But the one thing he says, you're going to need an axe. It took me a few seconds, like quite a few, I hate to admit, to say axe, axe. And then it dawned on me, because I didn't finish a sentence. That was kind of it. And it was like, oh, axe. So that was kind of a movement for me. I'm like, oh, I understand what he's saying. I'm not going through my roof. That is not an option for me. So my point in saying all of that there was this general drumbeat of you need to evacuate. But for most of us, there was no history of this and we'd never seen anything like this. So that was really kind of where we started on Sunday before the storm actually hit.
Yeah, it seems like when people see things on the news, they don't really believe it's going to impact them. And it's that more localized communication that is much more effective. So did you actually receive any communications about the hurricane from, let's say, your employer or your neighborhood HOA that you might have maybe trusted a little bit more or other people would have trusted more?
There really wasn't a lot of this mass communication stuff. It really was more local news. And so what we were doing is you're talking with your friends and family, your neighbors, and saying, what are you going to do? Are you going to stay? Are you going to go? So there was a lot that was very localized. I mean, I'm not even talking about news-wise. I'm talking neighborhood by neighborhood, family by family. What are you going to do? And that's really the conversations that people had.
Talk more about the experience of the evacuation. It seems like it was pretty chaotic. A lot of people just deciding, I don't need to go. Others saying, I really need to go. Just no one knew what they were doing.
We actually at the time had ContraFlow. And ContraFlow is where they turn all the highways going in the other direction. And so to understand ContraFlow, it really takes a long time to set that up. So we really couldn't utilize ContraFlow. It's a day before the storm hit. So you're kind of waiting I always tell everybody it took me 14 and a half hours to drive to Dallas from New Orleans.
Wow.
It's a seven and a half hour drive to get there. It took me 2.5 hours to get out of the city of New Orleans. So the actual evacuation itself was beyond stressful. It was bumper to bumper traffic all the way up to get to Dallas. I mean, it was a logistical nightmare. And the things that people forget is when people are evacuating, they're not just taking their car. They have an RV, they're taking their RV. They have multiple cars, they have that. If they have a boat, they're taking a boat. So anything that people have of value that they can attach to the back, they're bringing that as well. So the infrastructure, even today, is not really set up for that type of evacuation. It was horrible. When you look at evacuations, Katrina was considered one of the most successful evacuations in the history. 80-85% of the city actually heeded the warning. So that is unknown.
Wow.
The 15-20% that stayed, those were the ones that didn't have the means to get out. We get a lot of questions. Sometimes I spent a lifetime talking about why didn't people leave? They didn't have the means to leave. Didn't have the cars, didn't have the money, didn't have access to that. And then when you're there, wherever you are, it's multi-families, it's multi-people. The whole idea of an evacuation, especially for us, it was tough. I mean, I don't know how nicely to say it, but it was really, really tough.
Yeah, it seems like these situations are just a million shades of gray. It's not black and white. You can't just say, oh, well, you should have just left. It's like, well, I got my family, my elderly mother, et cetera. It becomes very complicated.
It really is. And part of it is you're asking people to leave their largest investment. And you don't know what that means. You don't know what you're going to come back to. And for most of us, when we did evacuate, we prepared for 3 days. Because typically that's what happened. You evacuate, you go for 3 days, you come home. So you don't really have anything. I had 3 days of clothes. I had some money. I had like $35, had a couple of credit cards, and that was it.
So when did you actually return to New Orleans? And what was it like when you arrived?
So it took us 8 weeks to get home.
Wow.
So depending on where you lived was depending on how quickly you're able to come back. And so I stayed simply, a lot of it had to do with my elderly mother. I didn't want to bring her home. There was no access to any resources there. And so you have to think about hospitals, doctors, gas stations, food. With Katrina, every system failed. Any plan, anything, it didn't matter, it all failed. That's not an issue of fault. I know these people. I know how hard they worked. But we were unprepared as a country, as a city, and as a state. We were unprepared for this. So it took me 8 weeks to get home. I got home, and I often tell people the surrealness of this. I can remember driving my mother down a street that we both known for years, and mud markings on trees were halfway up.
Wow.
So you're looking at mud all over my head. 18 feet of mud, 12 feet of mud. So you're looking at this and there's nothing there. I mean, the houses are there, but obviously they're empty. Some of them are in the streets. I mean, roofs are everywhere. I'd seen where 3 cars were wrapped around light poles. You saw cars on roofs. And the thing that I remember distinctly was it was no sound, like nothing. You didn't hear a bird. You didn't hear animals. You didn't hear dogs. You didn't hear sirens. It was dead silent. And it was weird because when I was in a building in Jefferson Parish, so Jefferson Parish wasn't as affected because the levees didn't break on that side of the levee, but I'm sitting on a 5-story building in Jefferson Parish looking out over Orleans Parish and it was black. That's a city there. There's like a light here or a light over there, nothing. And of course, we didn't have streetlights. You didn't have stoplights. Stores weren't open. You just kind of have to drive around and look for stuff. You know, you stand in line everywhere you want. That's why we learned to stand in line. Everything was 2 hours. Didn't matter where you went, 2 hours. So you're in line 2 hours. You know, you go to the post office if they're open 2 hours. You can't get your hair cut because they're not here. So it really made the city really, really small. So your new best friend standing in line next to you at the grocery store, the conversation was how you made out. In our speak, that means how did you do? And the conversations were raw. It was raw because you heard about people who lost family members. You heard about people sharing with you they lost everything they own. And they're grateful that they're alive. You heard about the people that were trapped in the attics. And there was a lot of that feeling of community that existed there where we had this feeling of shared pain. And I often tell people that this was a line for us. Like it was pre-Katrina, post-Katrina. And those that were here really talk about those things, like the essence of those things. And not only what it was like after, but, you know, watching it on television, well, you know, we made out all right, but the levees broke. And then you're watching the water rise. And then it's like, what is this, right? And then that's the surreal part, right? You're seeing people in boats going down a street that my friend's family lives on. What is that? You can't even, you know, you're seeing the street signs, and that's all you're seeing, or half of a street sign. That's what you're seeing. I mean, 12 to 14 feet of water in some places. And I mean, that's something that you hope that no one ever has to see again, that that doesn't need to be experienced. Cause that, I mean, I don't know how nice it's unnerving. I mean, it really is something that is burned into my mind for the rest of my life, and something that I hope I never have to see again. And I hope the same for everyone. So the coming home, there was a relief in that, to touch it and to see it and to smell it. The smell was atrocious. I mean, how many houses do you muck out? You know, you're in mud up to your knees. A friend of mine's mother lost her wedding ring. We're in their house in knee-deep mud trying to find this woman's wedding ring, which we were able to find.
Wow.
We had the Katrina cough, which everybody knew what that was. It's because the mold and the mildew everywhere. And that's just kind of how it was. It was like that for a very long time. And in many ways, 20 years later, we still see the effects of Katrina today. You don't go back to normal, you have the new normal.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like it was truly apocalyptic. So what was your impression of the response from government agencies and other social services to help out?
So our systems, our social systems, so our state and local systems were overwhelmed. You can't respond to an event when you're in the event. So you're looking at, what about emergency managers? Well, they're worried about their own family. Police, fire, EMS, they're worried about their own family. They're doing the best they can. They're in a situation that is overwhelming. So when you talk about the response in the immediate area, they did the best they could. And, you know, I have many police friends that were here, and the stories that they shared with us are horrific. One of my friends said to me, you know, Bonnie, have you ever woken up one day and looked at your family and said, I don't think I'm coming home today?
Ugh.
And I said, what did you do, buddy? He said, I kissed my wife, I kissed my daughter, and I went. I mean, how do you not honor that? But when you talk about long-term recovery for us, if it wasn't for the American population, so the people of America who actually showed up in droves, faith-based organizations, nonprofits, civic groups, university groups, we would not be here if it wasn't for them. And that's why we here owe this debt of gratitude for the citizenry of New Orleans.
Was it all positive, or there were potential negatives too with all this money rushing in?
Well, I often talk about the unintended consequences of money. So we went from how you made out to where's mine. So is that truly the unintended consequences of money? Because you're seeing somebody getting something or somebody receiving something. You're like, wait a minute, where's mine? And I don't know what the answer is, Peter. You know, I think about this. I mean, obviously, 20 years, you know, I've changed my life since then to kind of look at this, but I don't know what the answer is. But I know that there are unintended consequences of money. And so instead of looking at money from the top down, you need to look at it from the bottom up. So you talk about resilience and you talk about all of that, where people are in the socioeconomic stage. You know, there's nothing that's equal. You just want equality there or some justice or something there. But the unintended consequences of money flowing down really started to drive wedges between families, between neighborhoods, between places. You know, people are trying to help. But if you didn't get something, then in many ways you were left out. And I understand how that feels. If you don't have anything to begin with and you see somebody that kind of had something, you're not getting anything, I understand how that could be an issue. I mean, I really understand that. So I think we have to really look at this in a different way.
Yeah, it sounds like it could really change the fabric of the community moving forward. So what were some of the longer term impacts you observed as New Orleans rebuilt?
Immediately was the way it looked, because a lot of houses had to be torn down. And so what we had is, you're driving through a neighborhood, what we call the jack-o'-lantern effect, right? So you had a house here, an empty lot here, a house that needed to be sold. Even in Jefferson Parish, there was the debris everywhere. And there is a street in New Orleans that the street itself, the neutral ground, otherwise known as the median, is several blocks wide. And it's about 12 blocks long. And this had green debris on it that was five stories high all the way down. you drive by like, oh, that's a mountain, right? Because we don't have that here. So, I mean, you see that stuff. And of course, it's moldy and all that other stuff. In Jefferson Parish, a lot of gypsum board. So a lot of the streets were white simply because of the sheetrock coming out and all of that. In St. Bernard Parish, you had houses in the streets. That was one of the most affected parishes that we saw. The long-term effects is you lost a mass amount of population. You lost a lot of what we call the mom and pops, the local restaurants, those places closed. So as we say here, ain't there no more, which means it's not here. So you're looking for, you know, Maison Blanche, which is like a Macy's, right? So not here, it's gone. You know, you look at a D.H. Holmes, as we call D.H. Holmes, it's not here. You look at local restaurants, not here. It's the fabric of the city that's lost. And our biggest concern was our culture is very diverse here. And so you look at our African-American community that was dreadfully affected. So the concern was, will they come back? Will we lose this? Will we lose what makes New Orleans unique? Will we ever have that again? Will we ever celebrate again or reach back to what New Orleans is? Fortunately for us, it did not go away.
Well, you decided to go back and commit to the city. So how did this experience impact you personally and professionally?
So when I finally came home, I mean, I remember watching this and I felt like I had a gut punch. I don't know how else to describe it. And I had spent my lifetime in the IT industry. And after that, you know, there's nothing to do. So I just started getting invited to go to meetings. So I went and I started to really begin this quest of understanding why. Why did things fail? And not holding people to account, but understanding what happened. Because it, for me, it wasn't about excuses. It was about understanding. And it was about not duplicating this and saying, you know, this was kind of a big deal and we need to learn from this and kind of take that. And so for me, my whole career since then started that day. I was working with the Louisiana Small Business Development Center at the time. I went there for help and I had a 3-month contract that actually turned into 3.5 years. So I worked with a lot of businesses in recovery and was able to kind of help people try to recover from a business perspective because that's kind of what I knew. And that was the way that I could contribute to that. And at the time, the ACP actually came to us, Association of Continuity Professionals came to us and asked us to start a chapter. And I tell everybody, don't ever do this. I got up in the middle of this conversation, went to the bathroom and came back and was elected chapter president, which is a true story. So don't do that. Don't leave a meeting. Just stay there to the bitter end. And that's kind of how it started. Because for me, out of the IT industry kind of flowed into this next conversation of what is continuity from a business perspective. So, you know, in many ways, there's always positives that come out of bad things. And that's really part of it, right? And it's not because I was resilient. It was because I wasn't going to quit. And yeah. That doesn't mean that I wasn't going to quit. It means I wasn't going to quit on my city. I wasn't going to quit on, you know, my friends, my family. I wasn't going to quit. This was not okay with me. And I knew that I needed to do something. And I had to figure out what that something was and where that fit for me. And I think that's for everyone.
Disasters often have a way of bringing people together and presenting new opportunities. So was that your experience? Obviously for you it was, but just in general in New Orleans after Katrina.
So Peter, one of the best stories I like to tell folks is, so after we had Katrina, you know, I was in August, we're struggling, you know, throughout the fall and all that. And there was a kind of a thought like, are we going to have Mardi Gras? And there was a lot of external dialogue about that, right? And so Mardi Gras happens. Now I don't remember exactly when it was, maybe March, February, March, you know, it's usually that time. And Mardi Gras isn't dictated. Like there's no one person in charge, right? You got to be clear on that. It's not governed by the city. Each and every Mardi Gras crew, otherwise known as a club, is self-contained. So you pay for the privilege of riding in a parade. You pay for that. But there was a conversation, even amongst like where you, how you made out, was, should we have Mardi Gras? Is that something when you've lost so many people?
Yeah.
Do you celebrate? And there was a lot, like, as a lot of external dialogues as well. You know, people asking, you know, from news agencies, are you going to have Mardi Gras? And the conversation kind of came to, yeah, we're going to have it. And I often say in describing of Mardi Gras, it's a celebration that we have for ourselves that we invite the world. Mm-hmm. Right? We're very clear on that. We're going to have it, but we invite the whole world to come. Yes, come to Mardi Gras. It's loads of fun. You too can do this. But what we decided, and it was kind of the collective we, right? Not me or we, but the collective part of New Orleans is that we're going to have Mardi Gras for us. We're going to have it for us and celebrate the fact that we've made it through. And even though we're still in the middle of it, we're going to continue on. And that kind of was, in the way to describe it, where the needle kind of really shifted. That's kind of what said, yeah, okay, we're going to be okay here.
Well, in your opinion, what were the biggest lessons learned from Hurricane Katrina when it comes to emergency preparedness or business resiliency?
Is that you have to think of the worst case scenario. And no matter what, you're never going to be prepared. And we'll talk about that quickly, is the difference between preparedness and response. Like I talk about preparedness, you say you get prepared. I always look at that and saying, you know, you get your hurricane supplies together. By the end of the day, you've eaten them. That's preparedness. Resilience is a state of being. So emergency managers need to understand that things are going to go wrong. The end. Business continuity, it's going to go wrong, right? But it's how you prepared for that. How resilient are you that carries you through no matter what happens?
Well, what advice would you offer for business leaders listening today about preparing for the unexpected?
Step back and listen. From a leader's perspective, leaders need to listen. So I often say when I'm outside talking to folks is, what's the one thing that keeps you up at night? And depending on where you are in an organization, it's going to be different. But this idea of business resilience, what I often say is that you're looking at your business in a different way to see the things you don't see. See the things that are in that drawer. You know, everybody has that drawer. Or see the things in your closet that nobody opens, right? Or under your bed. That's really how to make it between like today, tomorrow, no matter what happens in the upcoming months, days. It doesn't matter if there's a major event. It's tomorrow. Can you make it to tomorrow? And that's how you do that, is by really stepping back and looking at things very differently. Ask the questions that nobody's asking. I always ask, what are we not asking? Mm-hmm. What are we not seeing? Because if you see it, then I understand that. And I understand everybody sees things differently. But what are we not asking is a completely different question. And that's what we're not doing.
Well, reflecting on 20 years since Katrina, what gives you hope about New Orleans and the future of resilience work?
You know, we're still here, man, and we're not going anywhere. I mean, I think that what we're starting to see are events, and unfortunately, this is not a good thing, but events are happening more places and they're more catastrophic in many ways. And I think that the experience that we have is seeing this and knowing this and changing the dialogue about this. So I am optimistic that there seems to be more of a collective. But I often say that that starts when people start asking the questions, right? Someone in their own organization has to start asking the questions. You need leaders in this. You need people to step up and say, wait a minute, wait, what is this? And I think that's the lesson, is that if you rely on the same old, you're going to get the same old. And this younger generation, they're not doing that, but they're asking different questions, which is good. I work with them to kind of give them my experience and my thoughts and to feed that enthusiasm, because it takes initiative and it takes a desire and a willingness to stick your head out, even though you know it may not be welcome in that moment.
Well, Bonnie, thank you so much for being here today and for sharing your story with us. It's always great to speak with you.
Peter, it's always great to speak with you as well. And, you know, I can't thank you enough for allowing me the opportunity to share my stories. I really do appreciate it. I wish you guys a very happy day. So take care of yourselves, buddy, until I see you again.
Thank you very much. Well, it's very moving to think about how much emergency management has evolved in the 20 years since Katrina. And I hope you all gained some food for thought on the importance of establishing and maintaining resilience. To learn more about Bonnie and her work with Tulane University, click the links in the episode description. You can also watch the video highlights on Alert Media's YouTube page. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review the show wherever you get your podcasts. Stay safe out there.
Thank you for listening to the Employee Safety Podcast from Alert Media, the industry's most intuitive emergency communication and threat intelligence solution. To learn more about how to protect your people and business during critical events, visit alertmedia.com. Until next time.